Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. What creates a successful society? And what dooms the states that fail? Many have argued that geography is king. So a country that's sitting atop an arid, desert-like land is sure to be at a disadvantage. Others argue that the key is culture. Some cultures may be intrinsically less well-equipped to deal with complex financial markets, or perhaps they even place less emphasis on hard work. But my next guests say that understanding why nations failed in the past and the key to predicting why they will fail in the future boils down to something completely different, a rationale that may tell us a lot about where America has been and where it's headed. Darren Acemoglu is professor of economics at MIT. James Robinson is professor of government at Harvard. And together, they are the authors of Why Nations Fail. Thanks to both of you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah.
So I want to start with a story that you have in the book, which I think is a very interesting illustration of where these fault lines can occur. And it's the story of a town that's on the U.S.-Mexican border and is essentially the same town in Mexico and the U.S., except the people who live there feel very different about it and their lives are very different. So, Darren Acemoglu, tell us a little bit about this town and why you focus on it in the book.
Well, I mean, the town is Nogales, and it's actually not a unique town. There are many other towns like that around the world and along the U.S.-Mexico border, which are essentially separated by this border. And then the two sides of the border, you see similar people, but with very different living standards, with very different living arrangements. And if you try to sort of explain those differences by geography, you won't find much geographic differences between these two places. You won't find any cultural differences. These borders are pretty porous, so people travel back. It's the same sort of people who have lived there for centuries. But they are, of course, under very different institutions, because in one case, it's the U.S. laws, U.S. customs, U.S. political and economic institutions that are ruling the place. And in the other, it's the Mexican ones. And you see big differences in the way that lives are led and big differences in the economic outcomes, in prosperity and poverty, living standards, life expectancy. And I think this is sort of a clear and simple illustration of how these institutional differences are at the root of fairly big differences across countries.
Now, James Robinson, somebody might say, well, maybe there is a cultural difference, not necessarily that these people are different religions or celebrate different holidays or even eat different food, but there are people who are part of America and there's a sort of American work ethic, let's say, versus a Mexican work ethic. Is that a possibility in trying to explain the difference in Nogales?
Well, it's a possibility, but I don't think it's a reality. I mean, I think that, you know, I don't see around the world big differences in people's aspirations or what they want for themselves or their lives. But, you know, it's certainly true that some people work harder. In the United States, people work longer hours than they do in large parts of Europe, Western Europe or Northern Europe, for example. But I think that's really a response to the incentives people face, that people have much higher incentives for working hard or innovating or creating, starting a new business in the United States than they do in many other parts of the world. You know, in sub-Saharan Africa, where they may be worried that they'll be predated on or they can't get secure property rights. So I think to the extent that you see Mexicans or people in the United States working harder or less hard or working longer, that's really a response to the institutions that structure their incentives.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the difference in the quality of life. I mean, it is very stark. You have an average income in Nogales, Arizona of $30,000, in Mexico of $10,000. What is the U.S. then doing right? If we were to take either Arizona or anywhere, what are they giving their citizens that the government of Mexico is not giving their citizens?
Well, I think they're giving them opportunities. You know, I mean, we illustrate this in a simple way. We try to use these stark examples. We illustrate this through the career of Bill Gates and Carlos Slim. You know, so that's sort of iconic, perhaps, of the difference between what the U.S. is giving its citizens as compared to Mexico. You know, how did the two richest men in the world, you know, more or less, Warren Buffett is up there, how did Bill Gates make his money? Well, he innovated. He created software. He's an innovator. Sure, he wanted to be a monopolist. Every businessman wants to be a monopolist, you know, if they can get away with it. How did Carlos Slim make his money? Political connections, insider privatization, completely different. And I think very different in a symbolic way.
And Darren Acemoglu from MIT, I think it's really interesting, this Bill Gates example, because you say in the book, individual talent, it does matter. It's, we don't want to discount the fact that Bill Gates worked incredibly hard to get where he is. He's competitive. He's smart, just intrinsically smart. But he didn't necessarily fully make it on his own.
No. I mean, I think he didn't make it on his own because he relied on the education system in the United States. There are probably many, many talented people, some of them perhaps as talented as Bill Gates in sub-Saharan Africa, who don't go to primary school. They start working in the field at the age of 8 or 9. Bill Gates had access to very good high schools, to very good colleges, and then he was able to, he didn't finish Harvard, but he was able to team up with pretty good people. And then from the get-go, he was functioning under the laws, corporate laws, and the corporate relations in the United States that actually enabled somebody very young, just like Google. You know, those people were able to sort of do something that's probably unheard of in many parts of the world. You know, 20-year-old nobody is able to start a company. That, again, is possible because of A, the laws and customs in the United States, and B, because people are fairly confident that if they are successful, they're going to get the benefits of this. So they actually have the incentives to do so. So as Jim said, you know, two things that are crucial here are opportunities and incentives. United States provides opportunities to people. It doesn't send talented people. It doesn't send people at the age of 10, 12 to the fields or to work as child laborers. It doesn't actually trap them in some totally dysfunctional education system in which all they learn is propaganda. But it also gives them incentives that they actually want to channel their talent, their ambition into doing things that is going to make them successful in the business world.
Let's switch to a part of the world that has been in the news a lot and that you talk about in the book, the Middle East, North Africa, Central Asia. For example, you talk about Egypt. And I know as you were writing the book, the Arab Spring was going on. And I think people in the U.S. may look over to the Middle East, to Islamic countries, and think maybe there is a cultural difference because there seems to be a lot of turmoil. There seems to be poverty. And maybe that's what makes Western countries different from these countries. What did you learn, Damon Acemoglu, from the Arab Spring?
I mean, I think, as you said, Islamic countries, especially the Middle East and North Africa, but also, you know, Afghanistan and Pakistan, they're very different from, you know, what you see in Europe or in North America, even Latin America. They are much less democratic. You know, if you leave the oil producers out, they're quite poor. Even when they have had movements away from monarchies, those have been very authoritarian, you know, led by a single party or single individual. So the view that many social scientists and certainly journalists and commentators had in the past is, oh, Islam is incompatible with democracy. People just don't want democracy. They want to be led, and they're also perhaps not adapted to Western technology. They're not open to Western technology, and perhaps that's why they're not prospering and they're not becoming democratic. And there are some very reputable people who've written versions of the late political scientists at Harvard, Samuel Huntington, Bernard Lewis, the Princeton historian of the Middle East. But in some sense, the Arab Spring proved two things. First of all, people actually had a very strong desire for democracy. They were willing to risk their lives. And in fact, the way that they achieved it was by using technology. So you don't see any of that closeness to technology in these people who were very skillful in using Facebook and Twitter in order to coordinate how they were going to go around all that repression in order to sort of fill up Tahrir Square and to bring the government down in Egypt, or same thing in Tunisia, same thing in Syria. And you know, that's not to say that there aren't some deep-rooted historical differences, but I think sort of easy generalization based on some markers of any sort of society, you know, be it Islam, be it Protestant ethic, be it sort of national cultures, I think they are at the end too easy, and we need to go beyond them to understand those social dynamics better.
Okay, so the question of why Egypt isn't Norway is not because of an antipathy to technology. But one thing you do, James Robinson, is you go back in the book and look at why is Egypt Egypt? Why did they have Hosni Mubarak? I mean, why the deposed leader of Egypt? Why were they in that situation to begin with? And you really have to go back a long ways to figure out why Egypt is in the situation that it is in now.
I think that's right. Countries, institutions, their political and economic organization diverge over very long periods of time. And the roots of the way Egyptian society functions today are in it. It was part of a colonial empire. We actually make an analogy between Latin America and parts of the Middle East, because the Ottoman Empire, which expanded in the early modern period and incorporated Egypt, was very similar in structure to many other types of empires. It was run from Istanbul, and Egypt was on the periphery. They were taxing, they were extracting. It was authoritarian, and then it was taken over by in the 19th century. Egypt was quite a success, actually. After the Napoleonic Wars, it managed to free itself from the Ottomans, and there was a period of very rapid modernization under Muhammad Ali. But then the British came, they wanted to build the Suez Canal, it became a European colony, and as in many colonies in sub-Saharan Africa, for example, after independence from Britain, it became authoritarian, was a military rule. So there's many parallels, with other parts of the world, which again makes this Islamic culture or something look much less unique and distinctive about the place.
And you say colonization often brought with it this idea of extraction rather than inclusion. So if America is a country that is generally a country of inclusion, where people get to vote and, people all get to drive on nice roads and that mm-hmm. kind of thing, what is a culture of extraction, and what does it do to a place like Egypt, say?
I think extraction is probably a very natural human impulse. It's in most parts of the world, you see people who would like to organize a society for their own benefit, to amass wealth and assets and income and power. Slavery, I suppose, might be the sort of canonical example of extraction, of where some people are just enslaved and have to work for other people. That's an organization of the economy which is disastrous for incentives or technological change or anything else. But of course, it's very good for people who are controlling or owning the slaves.
Right, and there's no benefit to those people. It's just labor is taken from them. So it benefits other people, but not the people who are doing the work.
Yes, and if you look at the U.S. South, for example, the U.S. South was much backward. It was poorer, it was less urbanized, it was technologically less dynamic, it had less infrastructure, less manufacturing, everything compared to the North or the West, and because it was based on this slave model of extraction.
If you look at the Egyptian economy, it doesn't have slavery, but it's organized in such a way that there are monopolies created for people aligned with Mubarak and his National Democracy Party. There's a lot of corruption at the top level, including Mubarak himself and his sons. And that all the logic of that system, both economically and politically, is again for those elites to be able to extract resources. And exactly like in the colonial empire, that's not always inconsistent with economic growth, but ultimately it's going to become a real barrier to economic growth. And as just James mentioned, U.S. South, at the beginning, U.S. South has a lot of valuable commodities. Like cotton made the U.S. South rich. At some point, U.S. South wasn't poor at all. But while the North and the West were growing, U.S. South was stagnating. And that's why by the time of the U.S. Civil War and in the 19th century, there was a fairly sizable gap between those two parts.
Yeah, and you talked about Hosni Mubarak, the former head of Egypt. At the time that he was deposed, it was estimated that he had accumulated $70 billion. Well, this is a country in which the net worth, I think, of individual people is something like 10-12% of people in the U.S. So a very poor country, but boy, he had done really well.
And he's not the only one. So look at Mobutu, who ruled the Democratic Republic of Congo, Zaire as it was called at the time. Same thing, people are starving, and he has several castles, huge Swiss bank accounts, private planes and all that. And you see that all around the world.
And you can see why it's good for the elites, and they might try to perpetuate it, but you can also see why there might be a revolution at some point. Okay, so let's talk about two countries, look ahead a little bit here, China and America. So let's start with China. China has been, at least over the last decade, and certainly if you talk to people in the financial world, talked about as an economic powerhouse. It's done obviously incredibly well, well over 1 billion people. This is where growth is coming from. But you question that a little bit in the book, James Robinson.
Yeah.
Where do your doubts about China's potential come from?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously China is very large, and I think that's part of what confuses people about how to interpret this experience. Yes, China's been growing very rapidly since the late 1970s. And as we point out, the reason for that rapid growth is they've made this transition towards what we describe as inclusive economic institutions. So they got rid of central planning and socialism and collective agriculture and all of that. And they've seen huge improvements in living standards and productivity. But what we point out is that if you look historically, having that type of economy or movement towards a more inclusive economy is not consistent with having this very extractive political system where political power is narrowly concentrated in the hands of the Communist Party. Indeed, there's many experiences historically which are similar to this. You know, in the 1970s, China was extremely poor, very backward technologically. Any country like that can get its act together for a short amount of time and grow very rapidly. The Soviet Union did it, as we point out. You know, when I was an undergraduate in England, we were told the Soviet Union was the economic model that everyone should be following. And everyone laughs when you say that now because we've forgotten it. But the Soviet Union did something very similar for 40 years.
You've got a great story, which I did not realize about the Soviet Union, where during the Treaty of Versailles, Woodrow Wilson's in Paris, you know, they're signing the treaty at the end of World War One, and these couple of envoys are sent to the Soviet Union because they're sort of busy with their revolution. They didn't send anybody to Paris. And the guy comes back, the envoy to the Soviet Union comes back, and he says, wow, this place is amazing. I mean, this could really work, what they're trying to do. This is the future. What happened?
He wasn't the only one. I mean, Lincoln Steffens, you know, he was a fairly famous journalist, one of the muckrakers and sort of an iconic character of the time. But there were many people who were totally taken in. I mean, the CIA was taken in. There were many CIA analysts who, you know, kept warning about how the Soviet Union was going to overtake the United States. And that was, of course, very important for the Sputnik generation, where, you know, we started investing so much in space exploration because we wanted to be competitive with Russia in that thing. And, you know, I think the fact that Russia was able to grow like that was even more remarkable because they did not even take those steps that Jim mentioned towards more inclusive institutions. They did not open up the sort of the agriculture to price incentives with Deng Xiaoping and the Chinese leadership, especially the local leadership, started doing after 78. They tried to do everything with a command economy. But despite that, there was a lot of low-hanging fruit. You know, when the world technology is ahead and when you are so inefficiently organized, in the case of Russia, you had a huge agricultural sector that was very inefficient. So what they did is that they sort of borrowed technology, some cases stole technology from the West and moved people into the heavy industry especially. And that sort of was enough to get growth going for a while. But then when it came to an end, it was a really bad end. Stagnation, total crisis for Russia because, you know, they weren't able to give any sort of incentive unless you were some very sort of elite scientist working on a very specific project. So they weren't able to generate new technologies. They weren't able to generate new products. And the whole economic sort of edifice started crumbling.
So that brings us back to China. You talk about this one businessman who in the 90s thought, things are going really well in China. Clearly, there's going to be a lot of building. So I have an iron and steel company, and there's going to be tons of need for this. And that company ended up failing. Why, James Robinson? What happened to this company?
Because he started to compete with more politically favored people. He didn't have the right political connections. So then the politically powerful people put him out of business, got him arrested. And I think that when ultimately you have a system like that, that fundamentally limits the possibility for sustained economic growth. And everything I read about the Communist Party suggests that the thing that they really care about is staying in power.
You know, we talked about Hosni Mubarak before accumulating $70 billion before he was deposed as leader of Egypt. You have people at the top of the Chinese government who similarly have billions of dollars in Swiss bank accounts all around the world, just sort of money set aside, maybe different family members have it. So, Darren Acemoglu, let's talk now about America. Mostly in this book, America is really an example of a country that has succeeded because of its institutions and its incentives. And I wonder what you are seeing now, especially in light of growing inequality in America.
Well, I mean, I think America has broadly inclusive institutions. These institutions have provided incentives for people, opportunities for people, but it's important to sort of be realistic about them. You know, those institutions haven't been perfect. They have always been challenged and they've had many imperfections. You know, United States had, you know, slavery in the South while the North was industrializing. Then slavery was abolished, but we had the sort of separate but equal Jim Crow justice and still very much of a black underclass in the South until the Civil Rights Movement. And that was a struggle too. So, you know, U.S. institutions have always had difficulties. And I think we have some sort of unique set of difficulties today because of, you know, it's a perfect storm. You know, the thing that makes political institutions really inclusive is that they provide political equality. They don't enable one individual or one specific social group or economic elite to dominate everything, to dominate political power. And U.S. political institutions, despite all of their imperfections, they were able to do that reasonably well. So even when people with money during the Gilded Age were becoming very powerful, there were movements like the populist movement and the progressive movement. You know, they were able to have their voices heard and finally use some sort of electoral success in order to start changing things. And I think the real danger in the United States, and that's why I call it a perfect storm, is that we have two things going on at the same time. One is that we have a huge increase in inequality. The very top of the income distribution has become much, much richer relative to the rest. The top 1% now commands over 20% of the wealth and income in the United States. That's a huge number. And then together with that, we have money becoming much more important in politics. You know, this is related to perhaps the sort of the modern media being so important for elections. It's related to lobbying and campaign contributions having become so central. And it's also related to rulings such as Citizens United that have really opened the sluice gates of money pouring into politics. And when you have these two combinations, it really creates a danger that United States is moving towards becoming an oligarchy. A society in which the very top are privileged, they are politically privileged, they are economically privileged in the sense that because they have so much political voice, the politicians are going to shy away from taking policies that are going to be harmful to them. So, you know, today in the United States, we have a lot of political problems, we have a lot of economic problems, we have poverty, we have educational system that's failing. And still, you know, the key thing is whether we should cut taxes further on people who make more than $2 million. So I think that is a little bit indicative that perhaps there isn't a total divorce between economic power and political power.
You know, I grew up in England during the heyday of Mrs. Thatcher when privatize everything, you know, became a dogma. You know, it was a sort of ideology that overrode common sense and even, you know, fundamental principles of economic theory because of a political agenda. I don't see that sort of thing as... There's always sort of stuff like that going on, but you have to look at the big picture, I would say. My view is very similar to Daron. I guess my recent experience, though, is that I tend to find myself as being the most optimistic person in the room. I'm not an American citizen, actually. I'm British, but I see that, you know, I study, you know, we study parts of the world which are very dysfunctional compared to the United States. And I think that, you know, we point out in the book that historically, the U.S. institutions have faced lots of challenges, but they've been up to those challenges. You know, not just the example that Daron gave of the Gilded Age, but you think about the 1930s and, you know, there was this halt we talk about in the book about how Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, tried to pack the Supreme Court and kind of dismantle checks and balances in the political system. And again, there was a backlash in society that the democratic system worked to stabilize that. So I suppose I still see, you know, yes, there are these dynamics that Daron was talking about, but I don't see this increase in inequality as yet having oligarchized the industrial sector, you know, or sapping the energy of innovative or private sector entrepreneurs, you know, in the way that I study Colombia, for example. I was just on sabbatical in Colombia for a year. You know, if you look at the economy in Colombia, it's all divided up, you know, monopolies, cartels, you know, there's no innovation. It's all about making connections with the politicians and getting favors and contracting. And, you know, and of course, you can find examples like that in the United States too. You know, in Chicago or whatever, or corrupt, but the system still works. You know, the example we gave in the book, Bill Gates, for all his power and enormous wealth, couldn't stop himself being dragged in front of the antitrust bodies and being penalized. You know, you couldn't imagine in a million years anyone like that in Colombia or Mexico being dragged in front of antitrust.
And in our last minute here, give us some of the countries, you know, just a short list of countries that you think may be poised to break through and go from maybe not so much prosperity to really doing well in the next 10, 20 years.
One of the examples we use in the book, or we talk about in the book, is Brazil, actually. I think one of the countries which seems to have experienced a kind of very fundamental change in the way its political system works with consequences for the economy, education, innovation, is Brazil. We emphasize, I suppose, a lot in the book this, you know, how persistent different institutions in society are. But we do also try to emphasize under what circumstances can you get these transitions. For example, what sort of transition is happening in Egypt now? You know, Brazil is the example we use at the end.
And Darren Osmoglu, you want to add a country? Or?
Well, I mean, I think a country that's interesting is the one that I come from, Turkey, which has a lot of institutional problems. And if you look at it, you know, you'll see economic failure, political failure. There is a real danger of same sort of political wranglings that have harmed Turkish economy and Turkish society over the last several decades coming back. But on the other hand, you also see that there is much greater popular participation both in politics and in the economy. You have the military now totally cast aside, and as a result, there is a new dynamism in the society, and you see that in much more robust growth rates in Turkey.
Interesting. We will be watching. I've been speaking with Darren Osmoglu, Killian Professor of Economics at MIT, and James Robinson, David Forns Professor of Government at Harvard. They are the authors of Why Nations Fail, The Origins of Power, Prosperity, and Poverty. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Cara. It was great to be here.
Thank you.
And coming up next, we are joined by a tech luminary and a pioneer of modernist cuisine, Nathan Myhrvold. He got his PhD in theoretical and mathematical physics by the time he was 23, studied with Stephen Hawking, then was picked by Bill Gates to run technology at Microsoft. And after retiring in 1999 at the ripe old age of 40, he decided, yep, I'm going to reinvent food. Nathan Myhrvold joins me to talk omelets, steak, and science. Remember, you can grab our podcasts on iTunes and link to them from our website, wgbh.org/innovationhub, where you can also find a link to Nathan Myhrvold's appearance on The Colbert Report. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.